It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are 72 days into the second presidency of Donald Trump. In that time, the administration has challenged many of the norms of U.S. governance, canceling spending mandated by Congress, attempting to close government agencies without congressional approval, and calling for the removal of federal judges who find his actions unlawful. Over the weekend, President Trump told NBC News he has not ruled out the possibility of seeking a third term when the 22nd Amendment, the amendment of the U.S. Constitution, says he is not eligible. This was not the first time he's mentioned this idea, and he's continued promoting it since.
If you were allowed, for some reason, to run for a third term, is there a thought that the Democrats could try to run Barack Obama against you?
I'd love that.
For his third term?
Boy, I'd love that. That would be a good one. I'd like that. No, people are asking me to run, and there's a whole story about running for a third term. I don't know. I never looked into it. They do say there's a way you can do it, but I don't know about that, but I have not looked into it.
Well, it's right there in the Constitution. All right. From the early days of Trump 2.0, people have been asking when we might reach the point of a constitutional crisis. Are we already there? And is the Constitution itself part of the problem? In a recent essay, Boston College professor Aziz Rana wrote that Trump is well situated to attempt a dismantling of the U.S.'s constitutional order. He notes Trump's unique ability to keep other Republicans in line and Elon Musk's boasting that he's running a corporate takeover of government. This confluence of factors, Rana writes, has produced a willingness to push far beyond the typical barriers that have restrained Republicans in the past. Rana's essay appeared in the New Left Review under the headline Constitutional Collapse. He also has a book he published last year called The Constitutional Bind, How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them. Aziz Rana joins me now. Welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
How would you describe the American constitutional order heading into the second Trump administration?
So the argument that I would make is that before Trump's return to office, the constitutional system has been facing a series of rolling low-level legitimacy crises. And it's because the basic framework is deeply undemocratic. By this I mean that in the U.S., representation is not organized around the principle of one person, one vote, but instead based on geography and the essential unit of the state. And what that does is it has all of these effects for the structure of Congress, the kind of disproportionate power that small rural populations have within the Senate, the way that state control, even in the House of Representatives, over the structuring of districts produces gerrymandering, how all of that connects to the Electoral College and the fact that you can have presidents win the presidency while losing the popular vote, how the role of the presidency nominating and the Senate confirming ends up shaping the Supreme Court. And so you can have a situation where Trump in the first administration lost the popular vote and yet was able to have nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court three justices, where Democratic presidents have been able to nominate and confirm just five since 1968. Now, what this meant was that it both created a situation where Trump was able to gain office in 2016 while losing the popular vote, but then it also had all of these deleterious effects in terms of dramatically transforming the nature of the Supreme Court in ways that are wildly out of step with popular sentiment. But then when Trump effectively attempted to overturn the 2020 election, so engage in an overthrow of a democratic electoral process, the constitutional system also made it incredibly difficult to hold him to account, made it hard to impeach, made it very difficult to use criminal process for indictment, and then it made it very difficult to remove him from standing for future elections. And we can just think a little bit about the differences between the U.S. and places like Brazil, where Bolsonaro attempted a very similar process and yet is not allowed, is barred from standing for future elections for an additional 6+ years. And so in a sense, this was a particular set of constitutional problems that both have elevated positions that are unpopular while at the same time transformed the nature of the Republican Party, where the Republican Party is very focused on using these minoritarian instruments, including vote suppression, as a way of sustaining and projecting power that views your typical one-person, one-vote structure as an almost existential threat, and then created the conditions for Trump to return in a context in which he's very clearly focused on targeting political enemies and providing various kinds of benefits to political allies through a system that was really unable to constrain his own deeply anti-democratic practices over the last decade.
And you also argue that the Constitution itself, as we in the late 20th century, early 21st century understand it, may be an aberration from what it was through most of its, 230-something year history. Can you expound on that?
So the U.S. Constitution is really interesting because, you know, growing up in the U.S. at the end of the 20th century, you venerate this text and you think of it as something that is continuous since 1787, that like we've had this single constitution. And part of the reason why we think of that is because the U.S. Constitution is perhaps the hardest in the world to formally amend. This is what social scientists say. It's very difficult to actually get an amendment passed. And what that means is that we have this idea of the text is basically the same thing, more or less, maybe with Reconstruction amendments from the Civil War period, that it's always been. But in truth, between the 1930s and the 1960s, really critical decades, the U.S.'s constitutional order, the meaning of this text, was fundamentally transformed. And it was transformed through landmark pieces of legislation, the Social Security Act, the National Labor Relations Act, which established collective bargaining, the Voting Rights Act in the 60s, the Civil Rights Act, Medicare, and that these landmark pieces of legislation that altered the terms of the federal government, the relationship between the government and its citizens, notions of national identity, were then constitutionalized not through formal changes to the text, but through Supreme Court interpretation that established the legitimacy of this overarching order. And so we developed a very different kind of constitutional framework that was built around a set of pretty clear principles. So like one principle was racial inclusion and the idea that the country is supposed to be open to all. A second principle was a set of very clear kind of civil libertarian commitments. So this is free speech, free exercise, and the idea that the state is not supposed to be able to engage in intense rejections of basic civil libertarian protections. A third pretty clear principle was that, yes, there's a foundational commitment to market capitalism, but it's supposed to be hedged in through this administrative state that was built through the New Deal. The fourth was, you know, an embrace of checks and balances organized through a strong and assertive Supreme Court. And then the fifth was the U.S.'s role on the global stage through robust presidential authority, but presidential authority that's understood as like national security that distinguishes between power that's exercised over there and power that's exercised domestically. I should say, now, that does not mean that American presidential power in the context of national security didn't produce various kinds of rights violations in excess, but that there was supposed to be a kind of balance in terms of limitations on presidential power. And there are two, this is, I think, key. There were two big sociological grounds, like things that were going on in the world that shaped this constitutional order. The first was the Great Depression. And what the Great Depression did in the context of labor organizing for the preceding 40 years was it produced a very powerful labor movement and cohesive working class life in the U.S. that was able to provide FDR massive supermajorities that could overcome all of these anti-democratic constitutional roadblocks so that you can get this legislation passed. So that's one key thing that happened that was very contingent to the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And then the second is in the context of World War II, and then especially the Cold War of the Soviet Union, the perceived need to win hearts and minds in a decolonizing non-white global South and to have a system that could compete effectively with the Soviet Union on the global stage, create center-left and especially center-right buy-in to these basic ideological terms. It meant the
unification of the Cold War. And I'm sorry to interrupt you. We need to take a break. We are going to continue this conversation with Aziz Rana. Let me invite listeners, if you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. We are trying to tackle the question today Are we already in a constitutional crisis? More to come after a short break. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. 2.5 months into the second Trump administration, the second Trump presidency, as the president has asserted a lot more authority than the U.S. Constitution seems to give him, the question we are trying to answer today is, are we in a constitutional crisis? And maybe more to the point, how has the nature of our Constitution led us to where we are now? We did ask members of our texting group about this. Brandy in Urbana wrote in, said, I think we've been in a crisis, constitutional crisis, since day one. Trump has been determined to undermine the judicial and legislative branches and consolidate power in the executive. And this term differs from his first in that he's surrounded by people who are unwilling to stand their ground for the Constitution. Modern-day Republicans only care about the Constitution when it benefits them. The legislative branch yielding its power to Trump is a constitutional crisis on its own. Christopher in Brimfield, though, said, I don't think we're in a constitutional crisis at the moment, but we're very close. I'm worried about the courts and what they can and will do. Congress doesn't seem to have any interest in their role in government. We're talking about all this with Aziz Rana, professor of law and government at Boston College. He had a recent essay in the New Left Review called Constitutional Collapse. He's also the author of The Constitutional Bind, How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them. That was from the University of Chicago Press last year. So before the break, we were talking about how the constitutional order was sort of rethought or redesigned in the mid-20th century because of the forces of the Great Depression and also the Cold War. And I'm sorry I had to interrupt you because we were on a fixed clock on the program. So I don't know if you want to pick it up from there.
Yeah, no problem at all. So I think the main thing is to note that these were very particular and contingent developments of the mid-20th century, domestic and international, that set the terms to create a very specific type of compact. And on the American right, one of the things that especially the Cold War did is it created pressure to contain the far right. We tend to think of Cold War repression, especially McCarthyism, as really focused on the suppression, sometimes violent suppression, of leftist activists, and there was certainly that. But one thing that's less emphasized is that it produced a Republican Party in particular that was willing to commit to elements of this compact because of the sense that there was a shared existential project. It's the reason why, from today's perspective, somebody like Barack Obama can sound a lot like McCain or George Bush Jr. But the thing that happened really with the fall of the Soviet Union is that over the course of three decades, one of the things that we've seen is a steady defection of the far right from elements of this compact, all of the things that I described, from racial liberalism to the kind of thick civil libertarian politics, to the commitments to the New Deal infrastructure, to the various elements of the constitutional order if it doesn't end up promoting kind of like the minoritarian politics of the right, and even to the broader project of the rules-based legal framework that sort of shaped American global power. And in a way, that leads to this question that you were just highlighting about, are we in a crisis? I think, as one of the commentators or one of the folks that wrote in noted, I think we're certainly in a crisis if you're thinking about it exclusively as, do we have a president that is asserting patently illegal power? Like, I think, when I teach my con law students, many of the actions taken are not really even 50-50 questions. They're things that if you're just giving sort of objective legal advice seem pretty clearly outside of what's acceptable. And so you have an assertion in lots of contexts of fairly patently illegal behavior and a willingness seemingly to defy the courts as well. Perhaps so far implicitly, not yet explicitly in various contexts. But nonetheless, this strikes me as that we're beyond stress test. We're closer to something like a crisis. But at the same time, I would say that Trump's actions kind of undersell the intensity of the moment. And this is the point about titling the piece Constitutional Collapse, which is beyond just crisis, what I think we're witnessing is a sustained attempt to essentially break down or collapse what persists as that mid-20th century order by pursuing actions that really go to the heart of all of the different elements of the compact. You know, when you essentially remove black presence from websites, government websites, when you very publicly fire people, when you go after the African-American museum through the Smithsonian, like this is a direct attack on racial liberalism. The broad repudiation of non-citizen, basic non-citizen procedural as well as speech rights, a direct attack on the civil libertarian politics, the dismantling of administrative agencies, alongside extreme assertions of executive authority. I mean, these really raise pretty foundational questions about the New Deal infrastructure, as well as like the typical constraints that have been placed on presidential power. And even the confrontation with the courts is a kind of attack on elements of judicial authority that have been presumed to persist. And so the question in a way is, you know, how to make sense of why we've gotten here. And what would it mean to confront this attempt at collapsing?
Well, now you've set up the perfect next question, because what does it mean to confront this attempt at collapsing, right? You point out that you think of what happened last November, right? Trump wins a narrow victory, and yet either, if you want to call it a media narrative or vibes, people in government and business have been behaving like he won a mandate. But there is not popular support for this far-right project. And yet, as you said, our system is anti-majoritarian. So with all those contradictions I've now keyed up, where do we go from here?
And I'd add another contradiction, which is, you know, I strongly support the importance of using litigation and the constitutional tools that are available as a way of constraining the various kinds of illegal practices that the Trump administration is engaged in. While at the same time, I think it's really important to appreciate how those structural features of the constitutional system, the fact that it's what elevated Trump to political authority despite not having popular support in 2016, what made it very difficult to hold him accountable for attempting to overthrow a democratically elected government, you know, that's part of how we've gotten here. And so it requires us recognizing the enduring limitations of our constitutional order while defending, given that these are the legal tools that we have, basic principles of little c constitutionalism that exist nonetheless within that. And that has to be done while then confronting that other contradiction that you noted, which is the truth of the matter is that Trump did not get to 50%. And that indeed, rather than thinking of this as a mandate, I mean, this is quite different. Even when running for office, Trump, from the debate stage, disavowed Project 2025. And, you know, public opinion data, interestingly, had citizens conceiving of Trump as a moderate by comparison with Kamala Harris. Indeed, his focus on his own personal enrichment and grievances meant that many people thought of him as not particularly ideological. But what's happened in office is that his focus on, again, whoever is closest and most loyal to him means that he's surrounded with really extreme ideologues who are only kind of tangentially related in various ways to the elected, the electoral Republican Party. And so they're pursuing actions that in many ways are kind of like out of step with what you'd expect from a party that's really committed to winning elections at 2 and 4 year cycles. And even somebody like Musk, yes, Musk is using his money to throw tons of support behind specific candidates, but he only has a kind of instrumental relationship with the Republican Party, which is to the extent that it facilitates his own project of essentially liberating or freeing business from the types of classic New Deal and democratic constraints that have been historically imposed. And so that tells us something interesting, which is so long as the U.S. has more or less competitive elections, it's not really the case that this set of policies can be authorized and reauthorized through electoral victories. I mean, it's very likely, or like one of the possibilities, again, would be that, not unlike what we just saw in Wisconsin, that Democrats may find themselves gaining more electoral power over upcoming elections. And that's really different, for instance, than FDR. FDR was able to initiate in the 30s a transformation in the constitutional system because he had massive landslide supermajority support. He won in 1936 with over 60% of the vote. His party had, and New Deal-aligned politicians were basically 80% in the House and the Senate. He was able to win election after election. And in a way, even the use of executive order and this aggressive assertion of executive power is a function of the political weakness of his base. He has an incredibly powerful base. He's perhaps unique in American history, certainly modern history, in the control that Trump is able to assert over his party. And so it's definitely a powerful constituency, but it's not a majority constituency. And that's something I think that's worth keeping in mind when sort of reflecting on where to go from here.
This is one of those days where I wish I had a Joe Rogan-length podcast to talk with you, but we only have about 4 minutes left in our time together. What, I guess two main questions to end with, maybe. One, do you think we will have free and fair elections in 2 years and in 4 years? Because we've already seen an assault on Democratic-supporting law firms. We may see this coming for fundraising operations of Democrats, maybe through tax policy or something like that. We've seen imprisoning people who are supportive of Palestinian rights. Maybe imprisoning's not the right word, but you know, certainly targeting people who are non-citizens. Do you think we will have free and fair elections? And then I guess just, you know, what do people who favor small L liberal democracy, what should they be doing now?
Yeah. So, you know, I truly did not imagine that we'd have to very seriously contemplate these kinds of questions. And, you know, I suppose the thing that I would say is that one thing that's interesting about the 2010s is that the Republican Party attempted to constrain the voting base through policies that were built around voter disenfranchisement and suppressing the vote. And these proved somewhat successful, interestingly, in reshaping the internal dynamics within the Republican Party, Republican primaries, gerrymandering particular states. But they really didn't prove successful in reversing the fact that the Republican Party had moved from its Reagan heyday from a majority party to a minority one, and that probably the Democratic base remains, you know, a slightly larger political base. And I think one way to think about, like, even the policies that have started to be initiated is whether or not there are other tools now that Trump and those around him can use to succeed where those policies may have been more limited. We see this in the executive orders around limiting which votes might be allowed to count. We see this in the targeting of Democrat-aligned firms that would bring cases contesting, you know, efforts at overturning elections or various kinds of voter malfeasance. And we see this in the sort of bubbling talk about targeting things like Act Blue and the digital infrastructure of Democratic donation, as well as NGOs and the kind of civil society organizing around the party. And so, you know, one way to think of all of that is to make it harder to have free and fair elections. Yet nonetheless, it's none of this is foreordained. It requires contestation and opposition. And the thing that I feel like I can say is, to the extent that we have elections that are effective, I think that remains a potentially pretty powerful roadblock, and that really differentiates the U.S. from places like Hungary or Turkey, where you do have majority support behind authoritarian transformations. And then, just quickly before we end, like, where does that mean we should sort of proceed? First, I think it really emphasizes the importance of litigation, and that's both contesting all of these various executive orders, but it also emphasizes the importance of litigation by institutions effectively of civil society, universities, law firms, that where it's feasible, you need to use the tools that are available to contest policies. And especially because the courts themselves are likely to be sort of mixed in the type of outcomes that you get. The majority of district courts are Democratic appointed. As you go further up, and certainly by the time you get to the Supreme Court, that's where you really see Trumpist and right-wing control of the courts. But it means that there's the capacity to really slow down, through lower court opinions, policies, even if ultimately the outcome might be more mixed. And then alongside that, I think what you need is a real investment in all of the civil society spaces that can build an oppositional culture. That means investing in your unions, in your workplace, in your professional associations like bar associations, bars, and like highlighting the professional malfeasance and ethical problems of lawyers, for instance, targeting other lawyers because of who they represent. That's a violation of your legal ethics. These are all ways to assert various kinds of control. Universities, having universities as a site of contention and resistance. And then finally, I think it requires a real rethinking in the organization and structure of the Democratic Party, which to date continues not to be organized as an oppositional party, but rather still framed, I think, around a kind of compact and set of strictures about effectively norm following that no longer fit the times that we live in.
We're going to have to leave it there. Aziz Rana, thank you so much for being with us. His book is called The Constitutional Bind, How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them. We will continue this conversation. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media.